who could be behind it.
Well, that's what Kathleen was talking about. So the admin committee will be...
Good afternoon. Testing, testing. Good afternoon. Welcome to meeting 194 of the UAF Faculty Senate. Jane, can you take the roll, please?
Albertson.
Present.
Baker. Tory Baker. Barnes.
Here.
Berge. Bret Hart. She's on leave, and Amy Lovecraft will be attending for her. C. Chen. Anyone attending for Cheng Fu? Kaufman?
Here.
Cook?
Phil Patterson.
Phil Patterson for... Thank you. Condi? Anyone here for Mark Condi? Davis?
Here.
Okay. Dean?
Here.
Okay, Duke. Fallon.
Here.
Focesato.
Here.
Gibson.
Here.
Gustafson.
Here.
Hahn. Hardy.
Here.
Healy. Horseman.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Johnston.
Here.
Jolly. Anyone attending for Julie? Keeland.
Here.
Larden.
Here.
Lovecraft. She will be running a bit late. Marr.
Here.
McCartney.
Here.
Meyer.
Here.
Misra.
Here.
Moser. Dennis Moser. Newberry. Okay. Radenbow.
Present.
Shellcross. Short. Valentine.
Here.
Weber.
Here.
Webley. Winfrey.
Here.
Windsor. Yari.
Here.
Zhang.
Rorik Peterson here for Shanta.
Okay, thank you. And acknowledging our ex officio folks, we have Falk Wetman here today on behalf of United Academics. Falk is also an alternate on the Senate. Do we have anyone from staff council?
Here in the back.
Okay, Brad's here. Anyone from ASUAF today? Okay. Danny Shepard for athletics? Okay. Oh, out of town. Dean Herman? Is here. Our chancellor and provost are here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jane. I just have a couple of remarks. We have a kind of a full agenda today, so brief. Who just joined us? Okay. As you are all aware, there are the Board of Regents have asked the university to extend our academic program review to other areas, including research, and the research program review effort is getting up and underway. And Peter Windsor, who's the chair of the Research Advisory Committee, has agreed to serve as our representative on the Research Program Review Committee, so I wanted to make that announcement. There will be a visitor coming to the Senate. This is a long time in advance, but she did ask me to say this. Frances Isgrig has asked for some time to speak to us about safety training here and finding a way to make the safety training better, more effective, and more compatible with our schedules and so forth. So she's asked for some time to come talk to us about that, and that will happen in February because that's the first time that our schedules will enable that. So what I'd like to ask you to do is between now and then to be thinking about your experience and your colleagues' experience with the safety training here and coming up with some suggestions to make that a better system. So I'd appreciate your efforts on that. There is also two committees that are that Mae Marsh at the Office of Diversity and Office of Diversity and that Mae Marsh is developing and is putting together. One is a Title IX committee, a committee on Title IX, which is a lot of people think of Title IX as the athletic bit of rules and regulations, but it's actually much broader than that. It encompasses a lot of aspects of the workplace, and that committee, she wanted a representative from the faculty, and Danny Shepard has agreed to do that. So she will be serving on that Title IX committee, not just because she's a faculty athletics rep, but also because she seems well suited to that because of her role as faculty athletics rep. And then, sorry? Oh, okay. There's also a committee that she's setting up on disabilities. It's being a person with disabilities on campus, whether student, staff, or faculty, presents a lot of challenges. And as our chancellor can attest, since he went through a day recently where he was essentially put in a wheelchair. At any rate, May is putting together a committee on disabilities and fostering a respect for what it means to be disabled. Some faculty here may have had some experience with having disabled students in their classes or some other thing. We've been asked to come forward with some potential people to serve on that committee. I have some suggestions here, but I would welcome any of you or any of your colleagues who have a particular interest in that or can bring some experience to bear on that. And finally, I want to report that the General Education Learning Outcomes Committee has asked us to think about each university, this is, to think about the possible joining of something called the WICI Passport, or WICHI Passport. WICHI is the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, and it's a consortium of universities that are that have adopted learning outcomes similar to the one that we adopted in 2011, that is LEAP-based outcomes. And this passport system would enable students to transfer more easily among participating universities, not simply with general education requirements all fulfilled, which is currently the case, but also maybe with chunks of those fulfilled, that is, specific learning outcomes having been addressed through their coursework. We might accept them even if the coursework is not exactly the same. So that is something that we've been asked to consider, so I'd appreciate offline if you have any interest in that letting me know. And with that, I will turn it over to Cecile for her remarks.
Okay, I'm going to be really short today. Over the weekend, I attended the first workshop of the new fellowship program on e-learning called SITE. I don't know if you guys remember the email that was going around about that. So there's a group of, I think, 10 faculty from across campus. And I'm actually wearing two hats in this group. One is as an interested faculty member, and the other is as a liaison to the Senate. I think it's going to be very exciting. It's a three-semester process during which every participant works on a project and will partner with one or two of the course designers to really foster innovation and e-learning on campus. I think it's going to be really exciting, and hopefully will encourage and motivate others to innovate with technology and teaching. And we'd really like to invite Chris Lott, who is the group leader for the course designers, to come and speak to you. They've really got some great ideas and a lot of creativity and energy. So I'll keep sort of reporting on that as I go through that process. The other is just a plug for the theater. I don't know how many of you guys have seen Nickel and Dimed. I went for a second time this past weekend, and it's been extended for another weekend. So there's another Friday and Saturday evening that the play is going to be performed. It's really, really worth seeing. That's it.
And while Cecile was talking, I managed to finally unblur my eyes with my reading glasses and notice that I skipped over two important things that we needed to take care of, which is approval of the minutes from the last two meetings in September and October. I've reviewed them and offered suggestions and changes to Jane. Are there any other changes people have for the minutes to 192, which is the September meeting, or 193, the October meeting? I would entertain a motion to adopt those minutes.
Approved.
You just have to say so moved.
Move to approve.
Thank you. All right, and second?
I second.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the minutes are adopted. Thank you, Jane. And on the agenda for today, under new business, we have a scheduling issue, which is that the person who will be presenting three of the motions there can only make it due to scheduling conflicts at about 1:40. So when 1:40 rolls around, we will move to her presentation of those motions. All right. So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that change. And then finally, there were no motions that required the Chancellor's signature from our last meeting, and so there were none. One none signed, and there are no motions pending. Now we will move to the Chancellor's remarks.
And I'll also be brief, given the full agenda. a note on the Shaping Alaska's Future process, the System Office is doing formally SDI. There was a major workshop last week that I had intended to report on, but since I was homesick, I'm not going to report on that, other than to just indicate that I think what we're going to be seeing coming out of that, first a series of what are the effects that the President and the Board want to see out of any changes, and then leaving some room for us to determine how best to achieve those, while at the same time trying to look at how to make the student experience more seamless for those students who may migrate between institutions. And that really gets into issues of common standards. And there's one item on the Senate's agenda today, the math placement, is an example of what there is some concern at the System Office about different standards for different processes within the university. I would say is the best defense on that issue is for this faculty senate to continue to take the lead in bringing the other two faculty senates along, as you've done on the general ed learning outcomes, to where we get a standard, but one that is acceptable to this faculty senate. I think what we're going to see on the math placement, what is coming forward to you, is something that very well could be adopted system-wide, again, with this Senate taking the lead. And I just want to say I appreciate that you continue to do that. But we're going to need to keep looking at, are there other areas we can simplify the lives of students, the process, make common processes without really watering down the standards that this Senate has consistently adopted over time. So it's sort of going to be a delicate balance, but I would encourage you to continue taking the lead on those issues. The Board of Regents will meet this week to approve their budget request to the governor. I don't hold out a whole lot of hope for this year's budget, given the state of state revenues. We're now looking, the deficit numbers for the state for next year the estimates continue to grow. So I'm thinking that, you know, a flat budget may be about the best we get. We are, however, identifying what priorities we would add at UAF and the two sister institutions in the operating budget. Because it's an election year, it tends to be a larger capital budget, and certainly for UAF, the replacement of the heat and power plant is a very significant, largest single capital project we've ever asked for, and one that's pretty important that we have warm rooms for all of us to teach, research, and work in. And with that, if there are any questions, I can answer them if senators have them.
Thank you, Brian. And Provost remarks.
There were actually 2 days of meetings last week. First day on Wednesday was focused on leadership in a time of change, or how to be change leaders. All of the deans and directors and some of the other types of administrators around the system were invited to that. The Center for Creative Leadership led that and gave us a lot of exercises and checklists and information on how to approach leadership times. Probably the biggest takeaway message has to do with communication, making sure that people understand why there needs to be change, how change is going to be implemented, and what their role is in undertaking change. And so I'll try to take that to heart and communicate as much as possible about the changes that will occur. And most of those, unfortunately, are probably going to be driven, in, at least in significant part, by budgetary changes. We're not going to have as much revenue from the state as we have had in the past, at least not as much relative to our needs for covering fixed costs, which are going to be a bit it's going to be a bit difficult to continue to operate as we are, at the scope that we are, the size that we are, the breadth that we are. The following day on Thursday was, and is, because it's an ongoing process, intended to put some specific shape to the Shaping Alaska's Future to help us decide what the university should be over about the next five-year period. The format, as the Chancellor alluded to, was about describing effects, that is, essentially outcomes. What would we like the university to be or accomplish over the next 5 years or so? Some of the, or actually a lot of the effects that were proposed by the statewide leadership had to do with student success. Students graduating faster, student services being more student-friendly and more transparent to students, easier for them to access, a variety of things like that. There was discussion of working more closely and more effectively with K-12 schools in order to have better prepared students, partnerships with industry, focusing and our research on Alaska and Arctic issues and achieving excellence in research and so on. Now, the process, I think, was perhaps intended to be a little bit farther along than it was on the Thursday meeting. For instance, it was clear that the president had hoped to attain a pretty strong buy-in and agreement to at least the essence of the effect statements that were proposed in the draft statement that was circulated before the meeting and that was presented at the meeting. However, I think we did make a lot of progress toward defining what things we did agree to and what things there still needed to be a bit more work on in order to achieve the kind of consensus that they're aiming for.
Now, the document that was circulated before the meeting I've provided to the Faculty Senate leadership, we are expected as an institution through the Chancellor to provide feedback to the President and Vice President, Vice President Dana Thomas, by November 18th. And so certainly the Chancellor's Cabinet and other university leadership is going to be working hard to give the President the clearest possible input about how we see the future of the university. And it will be important for the faculty and the Faculty Senate to provide feedback. I'm not sure, because I haven't heard, whether Senate leadership or the Faculty Alliance is going to have separate input to the President or whether all of the input is going to flow through the Chancellor. But I will say that if it's decided that all of the input will flow through the Chancellor, we would certainly welcome your input on the future of the university.
Are there any questions for the Provost? Jane.
I don't know which of you this is for, but UAA is going through the prioritization process now, and are we going to be doing something like that?
The program review that has already been done for many years for academic programs and is being undertaken now for student services, administrative programs, research programs, and so forth, is intended to serve the purpose of seeing where our strengths are and where our weaknesses are, akin to but not identical to the process that UAA is following. I don't, perhaps the Chancellor wants to amplify that.
No, I think, you know, UAA's process is a is very quantitatively driven. I think ours is has a higher focus on the qualitative measures, and I'm comfortable that our academic program review fully meets the requirements set by the Board of Regents. Our addition this year to focus on research program review and on the administrative and support is intended to address the same Board of Regents requirement. But I think the process UAA is using, you know, we're all watching to see how it comes out. I think I've read some of the characterizations of it and I'm sympathetic to some of those, and I think I'm comfortable that we're doing the right thing for UAF.
I'm glad.
Debu?
Yeah. So I completely forgot what I was going to ask. I apologize. Anyway.
Thank you, Debbie. That never happens to anybody else, right? Glenn?
So if Provost Penricks, if you could just clarify the status of providing input to this review that you've described at the President's office level.
Well, that's up to the Faculty Senate leadership. That is, I've provided...
So it's yet to be decided.
Unless they've decided already, and I'll defer to them on that.
Okay.
We have received a draft document that from them, which, with their permission, I think we'll go ahead and post on the Faculty Senate website and invite your comments. And probably what I'll do is set up a discussion page to facilitate that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. David.
Yeah.
Debu.
Yeah, I remember what I was. So I understand that the budget is going to be presented to the legislature shortly. In the past, we had some academic budget, and I'm not going to dwell on that. But has the budget on academics particularly increased, have been increased this year, or remains the same?
Well, the budget request is
yes.
Increased to account for fixed cost increases, primarily salary and benefits increases. And there's a small amount, I think it was about $1.2 million, something like that. There's a small amount of requests for augmentations to programs. but it's obviously a smaller request than we have made in the past, but it's not really a decrease at this point. Remains to be seen, of course, what the legislature does with the request. It's only a request right now.
Okay. And there are, I should add, there are several items that are to be determined in there because we have ongoing collective bargaining negotiations, and until those agreements are in place, we don't ask for the money to pay for those agreements. And so there are, I think, three open negotiations right now. And so those numbers are to be determined. And the challenge is hopefully we'll achieve closure on those agreements in time for the governor's budget request when it goes in mid-December. We have had communication from the state legislature to not expect automatic funding of any negotiated pay increase.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Moving on now, the Curricular Affairs Committee, in the person of its chair, Reiner Newberry, has asked for us to have a discussion item today concerning a potential change that they're considering to the UAF catalog concerning the phrase.
Right now, about a quarter of the undergraduate classes have as one of the possible prerequisites or instructor permission. The other three quarters don't. One of the pieces of legislation that is being introduced today clarifies that, in fact, an instructor always has the right to override a prerequisite. So it's clearly will be, if it passes, it'll be clearly stated in the catalog that yes, this is a case, and it can be printed in several different formats within there. It's a little, how can I put it, crazy to have a quarter of the classes say or instructor permission and the other three quarters not say that. It either implies that the other classes you can't get in even if you have the instructor's permission, which isn't the case, and clearly the logical thing to do is to put for every single goddamn class or instructor permission, which seems, what's the word here, excessive, or simply take it out altogether with the understanding that the instructor always has the right to override prerequisites under appropriate circumstances. Rather than just doing that, we thought in Curricular Affairs and Curricular Review Committee, it would be best to bring this up to the Faculty Senate, have people look it over, and assuming that it is considered acceptable, that we go ahead and do that. So there would be a global change in the catalog that appears next year. And for the undergraduate courses, of course, I'm speaking from Curricular Affairs and Curricular Review Committee, which deal with undergraduate things, there would simply not be, some of the courses would say, or instructor permission, and others would not say, or instructor permission. None of them would say, or instructor permission, but rather there would be a statement in the or in the catalog that says, instructors can always override prerequisites as appropriate.
Okay, discussion. Laura?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that because if you have the instructor permission part in there, that implies that the instructor can be persuaded maybe by other students who contact him and maybe overrule it based on experience that is present. If it's not in there, I would see that as don't bother me, I stick to my guns.
And that is not the case at all. The instructor always has the right to override.
No, what I'm saying is that the instructor, if he does not put in there or instructor permission, is essentially implying to the student, don't bother me, I stick to my guns. I will not allow any overruling here.
So that we have, in fact, three categories of courses, courses for which prerequisites will never be overridden, courses for which prerequisites can be overridden, and courses for which the student doesn't have a clue as to whether or not prerequisites will be overridden. Is that correct?
I think if it's either says in there, that essentially would say the instructor entertains the students to contact them and say, yeah, okay, if you can demonstrate to me that you have the experience that is equivalent to what I require for you to be in this class, okay, you know, I might grant you permission, and another instructor would probably say, no way in hell, so don't bother contacting me. What we have to keep in mind here is that the catalog is different from a syllabus. So there, you know, in a syllabus, instructors clarify their own expectations about such things, but the catalog applies to that course regardless of who the instructor is. So in the catalog, rules have to apply more generally than they might on a syllabus. Different people teach the course. Different people may teach different sections of a course during any given year.
Glenn, then Debu.
Well, a suggestion. I think this is a matter of advertisement and communication in terms of what's received, not necessarily what's the official policy. We might just do something like this. Every time the word prerequisites is used, put an asterisk there and have that asterisk go to university-wide policy is that an instructor may always override the prerequisites upon their own volition or approval. That way the prerequisites are listed and the communication is made that, and in circumstances where the instructor feels it appropriate, it can be overridden without being wordy and repetitive.
Right. Debu and then Libby had a...
Yes. I just kind of polled our faculty, CEM faculty, at around 11, so I got three responses by now, and I'm trying to see through those. I'm not going to read those, but all that I've received so far feel that removing this is going to be a big problem, particularly for technical elective classes, and where we don't necessarily put a prerequisite, but we say instructor's permission is required. This is going to affect some of those courses grossly. For the required classes, this may be correct. You know, to remove it is not a big deal, and we don't have any of those in our required classes. But for technical electives and other type of classes, we do put up instructor permission because we get a whole lot of transfer students. We get a whole lot of students, international students from China, Mongolia, for example, in our college, and also people with experience that move in on the junior level. So this is kind of, I got at least two or three now that say that they would like not to be removed because the students get confused about it, don't bring it up with their advisors. They don't know whether they are eligible to even take this course or not. So this one helps quite a bit.
Okay, thank you, Debu. Libby, you want to?
We can address this in several places, other places in the catalog, at the beginning of the course description section where the numbering system is addressed, and also in the registration in what's called the non-degree portions, the actual policies and procedures in the beginning of the catalog. And we can put it on our website and in the registration guide, which has specific registration information. So we can address it in other places.
I'm curious about Glenn Jude's suggestion. I think it was Glenn's suggestion about putting an asterisk next to every prerequisite and have that reference a specific place in the catalog. Would that address the concerns that you had, Debu, do you think?
I can't say that for now. We have to think about this one a little bit more deeply. I would request an engagement on this one online so that we can send the feedback to Reiner for more, because I can send these couple three to Reiner immediately, but there might be more later, you know. So okay. I don't want to take a stand at this point on this issue because, you know, I know Rorik has a different view. He's from CEM. So there might be other views too, and we need to weigh those.
Well, I think this serves the purpose that Reiner and his committees had to get this kind of input. So anyone else want to comment here? Yes.
Yeah, is this, you're talking about classes where it says instructor permission required, mm-hmm. but I don't think that's what you're talking about.
Precisely, that's not at all what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Or thank you for that clarification. That's an excellent point.
Don't meet.
when instructor permission is required, then they must contact the instructor. That would still be there. He's not proposing that that goes away.
And what is this one, our instructor permission? I don't understand that.
This is the part you didn't mean.
So like Reiner said at the beginning,
that's what I intend to say, is that we have our instructor permission when somebody doesn't meet the prereq, but directly, but they can come to the instructor and demonstrate. So for example, I had two students from China who came and sat in my office and said, we know this subject, and I had an interview with them, and then I realized that they don't meet part of the curriculum, and so we had to design the course separate instruction for them. So it is very critical that we meet those because of the ABET requirements, accreditation requirements.
Okay. So Reiner, I think it sounds like what we'll do is go ahead and put up a discussion slot so that that folks can weigh in. I would encourage you to check with your colleagues, as Debu did, and feel free to funnel your comments onto that discussion section. All right. Thank you, Reiner. Okay. Are there any other comments? I should make sure that's all right. Thanks very much. Okay, next up we have old business. You may recall that at our last meeting we had considered and then tabled a resolution from the Faculty Senate that would oppose the any effort to ban the use of tobacco products anywhere on University of Alaska system grounds. And the comments at the time for this resolution essentially led us to reword the motion such that it included some wording that voiced what we were in favor of, not just what we are opposed to. And so that draft resolution has been reworded a bit, some more added to the rationale as well. And I would ask you to consider this and, vote for it. And it's attachment, it's the very first attachment.
Move to approve.
Second.
All right, any discussion? Are there any objections to this resolution? Seeing none, motion is adopted. Thank you very much. We move now to new business. Is Amy Lovecraft here? Not yet. Okay. Let us first consider the motion to approve the Department of Communication unit criteria submitted by the Unit Criteria Committee, and it's the second attachment. And Chris, yeah, there you are. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm the chair of the Unit Criteria Committee, and to give you some context for this attachment and the one from anthropology that follows, I just want to describe the purpose of my committee and the unit criteria process. The purpose of the unit criteria committee, as defined in the bylaws, is to review proposed unit criteria for evaluation of faculty submitted by the peer review units of UAF, and to make sure that they're consistent with the criteria defined in the Blue Book, that is the UAF Faculty Appointment and Evaluation Policies and Regulations. And incidentally, the various collective bargaining agreements are incorporated there by reference. The attachment that you now have in front of you is based on a standard template for all peer unit criteria at UAF. Everything that is in regular print rather than all caps is part of the standard template. And anything on this document that is in caps and, in the case of the COM criteria, bold-faced, are the special unit criteria that COM has placed into this document in order to clarify the way in which these criteria are to be interpreted in the context of their discipline. So that's some context that I hope will help you understand what this document is. Shall we move to discussion now?
Yes. So I'm assuming that you're moving to adopt?
That's correct.
Okay. And do I have a second?
A second.
Thank you, Glenn. All right. Now we can discuss. Comments, questions?
Chris, were there any issues that the committee discussed connected to these two sets of unit criteria?
Well, let me give you a little bit more context on these. The COM criteria are ones that had been adopted by a previous faculty senate after review, and part of what we discussed was that they had been previously adopted and the Blue Book hasn't changed. Some of the issues that came up with regard to this set of criteria was the qualitative nature of some of the criteria that are appropriate to this particular discipline. And so some of that is reflected in what they have here. They don't have numbers of publications. They have qualitative types of measures that they use. Is anyone else from the committee here and would like to add any additional issues that we talked about? That's what I recall.
I'm from the committee. I'm from the committee here.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, this was pretty quick and standard, and it was adopted by the faculty of both the programs, the communication and anthropology, right? I'm forgetting now.
We're on the comm ones right now. Anthropology is next.
Yeah.
And there were no real changes to it. So
there were no
major changes or anything. And if the faculty has accepted it, so the committee felt that they are comfortable. So we didn't think that committee.
One thing that we discussed was about the original agreement of the faculty from that college to actually introduce the modification, but to make sure that they were in agreement before actually doing the modification.
Thank you, Javier. Okay. Are we ready to vote? Okay. Are there any objections to the first one on communications, unit criteria for the Department of Communications? All right. Seeing none, motion's adopted. All right. The second motion is for anthropology. And Chris, you've pretty well said it already, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is also a motion to adopt unit criteria for anthropology, and they are in the same situation that COM has been in. These are criteria that had been adopted by a previous committee. They're not proposing any revisions to them at this time. There was some discussion of these criteria around the same issues that we've described as around the COM criteria. It was a quick process, though. We moved to forward these to the Senate for a recommendation that we adopt them.
Okay, thank you, Chris. And I assume we have, you're
move,
moving to
I
adopt
move
any.
Move.
Thank you. And who did that, just for the record?
Debu.
Okay, thank you, Debu.
I said I moved.
All right, thank you. Second? Great, thank you. All right, any discussion on this one?
I have one question.
Sure. Can you speak into the microphone?
Can you speak up a bit, please?
I just wondered if they've both been approved already. Is it just the standard? Is this just the time to go through this process again, or why are they both coming up for review again?
Right. There's a cycle whereby every few years the unit needs to review their unit criteria, make sure that they're still functioning appropriately for them, and then either revise them or just reaffirm the existing criteria. And in the case of both the anthropology department and COM, they have concluded that they need to propose no changes and are just asking us to reaffirm their existing unit criteria.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that.
It's a little bit odd in a way, because to a certain extent this is a fairly standard procedure and there's usually not a problem, but I don't want to get to this situation where we think we're just rubber stamping something. So we're trying to walk that fine line. So, okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we ready to vote? All right. Are there any in opposition to these unit criteria for anthropology? Seeing none, motion carries. And Amy, are you, I think I just saw you come in. Ah, there you are. Great. Okay. Amy, are you ready to, we'll now discuss the three motions that are coming up from GAC, from the Graduate Advisory Committee, Academic and Advisory Committee. Amy?
Correct. I'm, is that good? I'm the designee for DONI. This is the motion to start a Masters of Music program and delete the Masters of Arts in Music program. And these are the key points. The last accreditation review pointed out that the UAF Masters of Arts program in music isn't in compliance with the current accreditation standards of the National Association of Schools of Music. The music department feels that it doesn't have the resources in place to bring the current MA program into compliance, so they can't continue very long with the present program without losing accreditation. So then, as well, most graduate students in music are interested in performance-based degrees. Therefore, a Master's of Music program is more suitable for them than the current one. The Master's of Music program matches the strengths of the current faculty, and UAF would be able to keep its accreditation with the Master's of Music program, whereas they would lose it with the Master's of Arts program. Fourthly, students that wish to continue to pursue a Master of Arts degree can be accommodated, and they will be accommodated. In other words, the music program is willing to accommodate them through an enrollment in an interdisciplinary master's program with a focus in music. So for those of you not familiar with Write It, you can take an interdisciplinary graduate degree, and then it can be labeled with music, and that's what they would be willing to do for those students who still want an MA. Lastly, the music department has reached consensus in agreeing to both of these motions. So the music department itself is willing and able and believes in the switch, and we in the GAC voted along with them and voted that the start of the Masters of Music program and the deletion of the Masters of Arts program was appropriate. And that's it.
Okay, thank you, Amy. And just to clarify, these two motions are tied together, one to create this new program, and the second one is to delete the existing program. Okay, so it's kind of a package, but we're going to vote on them separately. So the first motion is the motion to create the new performance masters, and I would entertain a motion to adopt.
I'll move to adopt.
Thank you. All right.
I have a question.
And are you seconding?
No, he has a
question.
Oh, go ahead.
And I can answer some, and then Vince. Vince is also in music and can maybe answer other questions too.
So what would be the plan for the current students, actually? They will move to the new program or?
No, the current students will finish, right, Vince?
So they move to interdisciplinary.
Not if they're current.
I understand that the current students will finish under the MA degree designation, and entering students would fall into the MM category.
But Vince, can they also switch if they want to?
I believe I saw.
Yes, then you can delete that.
Anytime we delete a program, it has to be taught out. Mm-hmm. Provost Hendricks?
Actually, at statewide, we recently had a discussion in system-wide academic council that clarified, and that is we can continue to offer a degree that we choose to delete until we accommodate those students that were enrolled in it. Basically, we allow them to graduate under a prior catalog, and those catalogs are valid for a period of 5 years, I think. anyway, for a substantial time span. So any student who wants to finish the MA that they initially enrolled in will be able to do so.
Your other question, though, about can they automatically switch, my understanding is that they would have to apply to the performance because Master of Arts in Music is, and that's why there's this change, fundamentally different from the performance. So they could apply, but they wouldn't be given an automatic acceptance, I don't think.
Part of it has to do with our spring audition procedure, where I suppose anything could happen, but because we audition in March, we have virtually no spring starts. It's all fall start students, which in a way organizes and makes that sort of change undesirable or not necessary.
Answer.
Yes.
Are we having discussion now, or are we?
I was waiting for a second.
Oh.
Thank you. Thank you, Reiner. Okay, now we are.
Okay, good. I don't really know how to bring up what's happening inside me right now, but I have a couple of questions. One is, it seems to me this is sort of a radical change, and an MA in music is much broader, I think, than an MM, and I'm wondering what kind of impact this would have statewide. Are there any other places that would offer the MA in music, and what would it take to, in terms of resources, to enable the MA to continue? Because it seems to me that they're quite different, and it's a valuable intellectual pursuit and asset to our state to have an MA program, especially in Fairbanks, where our music life here is so phenomenal. So I would be sad to see an MA go. So that's
Vince, you know more of the history. I mean, this has not been taken lightly, and it's been a multi-year battle to determine this. And so I'll just start off by saying that if they stay as an MA, it is highly, highly unlikely that UAF or University of Alaska would find the amount of resources required to accredit that program. But then, Vince, if you want to maybe give a little bit of the history of how long it's taken to reach consensus to show this hasn't been taken lightly as a decision, that might help.
Sure. Maybe speaking to both ideas, I think since at least 1986, this idea has been floating around the department. Over the last 3 years, the graduate committee has met weekly to work on this. The idea with the MA, and I agree that there's more breadth there and depth, is in a review of our peer institutions and our aspirational institutions, we found that very few of them offer an MA and have moved into the MM situation, while they have offered other areas and concentrations, which is huge, but they also have huge faculties. Some of the institutions we reviewed had up to 84 music faculty. We currently have 11 or 12, depending on how you count, full-time, tenure line, or, well, maybe 11 tenure lines. So it was sort of discussed what would it take to offer an MA, and it would mean a lot of new hires, and I don't foresee that happening.
All right, thank you for that clarification. Now, any other any concerns about creation of this program? Because the first motion that we're voting on is actually, although they are tied together, the first one is a focus. The first one's focus is on creating the MM program.
Quick comment, please.
Sure. Go ahead.
This is Todd in Dillingham. I guess I didn't quite understand, and I'm a little concerned about the use of the interdisciplinary degree. Just briefly, it sounded like you're going to use it in music, and that's not interdisciplinary. So it would be a wrong use of a degree that's supposed to go across disciplines. Could you please explain that and make sure that that's not was your intent?
I can. This is Amy Lovecraft speaking, though I'm not privy to music. I don't know if I should then, though. I mean, I can explain it. But I'm not the person who designed that as the replacement for those interested in an MA in music. That would have been the music department. So,
is Laura Bender here? She's the only one I've ever heard explain it well.
I can probably explain
Susan, yes.
From my experience as past graduate school dean some years ago, yes, indeed, Todd is correct that an interdisciplinary degree needs to have components of more than one discipline in the graduate study plan that's associated with an interdisciplinary degree. For example, in order to win approval at the graduate school level, it's expected to seek courses from more than one department. It's also expected to have members of the advisory committee from more than one department. So an interdisciplinary degree in with music included would not be identical to an MA degree in music. However, it could certainly have a substantial and strong component of music within it. It might have, and then it would need other elements, say anthropology or something. If they were doing ethnomusicology, there would be a wide potential range.
Glenn.
So it is not a 1-for-1 replacement, and I don't think that the music department at any point pretended that it would be.
Okay. Thank you, Amy.
Yeah. So is that how we should interpret the requirements as laid out in this proposal, that there's a language requirement, there's history, and in addition to the music itself? So that they broaden the requirements to bring in the interdisciplinary elements.
They could, although, of course, the student, him or herself, would choose which other foci he or she would have in the university.
Yes. Okay.
Can I offer a bit of background on that? I am also in the music department.
Sorry, Karen.
It's okay.
I'm just focused on Vince because I see him in the committee.
That's okay. Part of the reasoning for the interdisciplinary, of accepting the interdisciplinary, because this was a long process and many of us were unwilling to give up the other aspects of the MA, which was the point that you brought up, and that was very considered. Part of this is that by only having a Master of Music in performance, what we're really doing is saying to people who in the schools, teachers, who, you know, I think the University of Alaska is really wanting to support in their continuation of their study and necessary study that they have to take, is that the interdisciplinary would allow them to do some aspect of music and then possibly even education. And if we could do that, then it really satisfies the music education component that was offered through the MA, and I think it's a really important part. Now, I have to say I have not done the research, and I don't think we have actually done the research to see how that would be integrated. If it could be integrated, music and education, and maybe, Susan, do you have any input into that?
Well, there's no reason that you couldn't have those two components within an interdisciplinary degree. There's also the music education program, though.
That's only in a bachelor's degree, though. We're talking about a master's.
Okay, yeah. In any case, certainly an interdisciplinary degree. There's no technical reason why it couldn't combine music and education.
Right. So you know, that being the case, I agree that a performance is a very limiting degree, and that there are lots of other aspects of the music discipline that can be addressed, and that's one aspect that I personally was concerned about, was the music education aspect, because we do want to support our teachers in their continuing education, and that's not allowed under the performance degree, because frankly, teachers who are teaching full-time don't have time to practice the necessary 6-7 hours a day to be able to come in and do a Master of Music in performance. They're going to have to go a different route, most of them, if they want to continue their education in Alaska.
Okay. Any other comments?
I just had one other thing. The verbiage and the rationale in the under the motion in the first paragraph is a little disconcerting to myself, and that's given, and the wording that I'll read is, given the profession-wide shift in the last two decades toward performance-based degrees, I don't think that's going to be in our best interest to include that particular verbiage, because I really don't feel that that's a shift. And, you know, if anyone watched the PBS NewsHour this summer in June and July, there was an 80-minute, four 20-minute sections, you know, dispelling this particular rationale, saying that really the profession-wide shift is toward other things such as music therapy and music education and other areas of music that, you know, 5% of Juilliard, which is the biggest performing school in the United States, 5% of their students actually go on to performance careers. And, you know, I think just giving that verbiage, we're actually limiting ourselves in the future, and that if we really want to expand this program, the Master of Music in Performance, and then maybe possibly add an music education component or whatever, that verbiage may get in the way of us being able to do that. So I'm just saying maybe we should just take that little part out and just say you know, it'll provide a better preparation for students applying to doctoral programs in music than the current Master of Arts. And that's my recommendation.
But this is the motion the department agreed to, correct?
Yeah.
I'm a little bit nervous about the Senate inserting itself into what is apparently a department kind of recommendation.
That's my opinion. It was expressed by several faculty members, but we did agree to this. I just don't want to see this limiting us in the future.
Right, and bear in mind that is the rationale, rather than the rationale is simply the argument for the motion. The motion is the only thing that is actually, and the rationale explains, but the motion itself is what matters. Okay. Are there any other items of discussion for this? Okay. I am going to call the vote. Now, keep in mind, we're going to vote on first the motion to adopt the new MM program, and then we'll consider the second motion. So right now, the motion is to adopt a new Master of Music and Performance. All those, I'm going to go ahead and do a roll call vote because I'm not sure we're going to have unanimity here. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
Okay, thank you. Motion carries. Okay, we move now to the second motion. This is the motion to delete or discontinue the Master of Arts in Music. And we've already had a fair bit of discussion on that, but I first need a motion to adopt it. Move to adopt, in other words.
Move to adopt.
Thank you.
Second?
Second.
Thank you. Okay. We've already had some discussion on this, but are there any comments specific to this particular motion that you'd like to raise now?
So, David, since I missed something, do I understand that some senators have a reservation on removing or discontinuing the Master of Arts program in music?
I did hear someone who was concerned about that, yes.
There are.
There was one comment voiced.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Glenn.
It's just a partly generic and partly specific question. Typically, in these situations, you make an assessment of the practical effect of continuing a program that does not have accreditation. So I'm assuming that the judgment has been made that the university would not be better off by trying to continue a program that would not receive accreditation. Can somebody explain that judgment that was made? Is this a real tight nexus between if you don't have this accreditation, you just don't get students? Is that it?
I would defer to the music department on that, or Amy, if you wanted to speak to that. But we have a couple of folks from the music department that may be able to shed some light on that.
I think Karen and Vince can. I'll just say one brief thing from what I've heard in the graduate level, and that is simply the resources available, the faculty to offer both would be stretched so thin. At least my understanding was that the performance degree would at least enable them to do something very well as opposed to maintaining the other program, which couldn't receive accreditation, and then that would not show the music department in the best light, obviously, that it could show itself. But that's only me hearing that at the graduate level as part of the decision, and Karen and Vince may know otherwise.
Well, again, this would mean more hires or new hires to run an MA program in compliance with our accrediting agency. I think we're talking about generalization and specialization here, and we can interpret any degree on those terms, I think. But an MA can be highly specialized, and in review of our peer institutions and aspirational institutions and other institutions that do offer MAs, they tend to be highly specialized with a heavy thesis component and academic backbone, which would, again, require additional instructors to teach those courses and to develop and create those courses. It would be lovely to offer everything we could, but our accreditation review came back and said that the MA we were offering looks more like an MM, and they asked us to meet compliance.
But I think the question was on the impact of losing accreditation, right? Was that the question? And generally, with programs that have accreditation or where that's an issue, losing it usually means you lose students because it's hard to recruit faculty because, you know, you just don't. It's a signal to potential employers, to other academics.
Well,
that the program
I think
is not
I understand that the rationale for accreditation,
yeah.
But I mean, what's been presented here, it seems to me like an internal motivation that the faculty really do feel that those accrediting standards are appropriate and don't want to go outside them. So that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, we certainly favor some competencies over others.
Yeah, in our last accreditation cycle, so prior to this one, which was 10 years ago, I believe it's a 10-year cycle, the comment was made that our current MA with its specific tracks of performance, conducting, composition, and music education wasn't really in compliance to what an MA really is, and that, from what I understand, was that they suggested we actually take the tracks out, the performance, the music education, and just call it an MA in music. And that would be one way to comply for the accreditation process. What the music department, I guess, has chosen to do has just say, well, we can't meet those under those tracks. Therefore, we're going to implement this new Master of Music and Performance only program.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments? It's a discussion.
Yeah, I got just I hate to keep running this interdisciplinary thing, but I feel pretty strongly that the way it's worded and on page 32, it just sounds like, oh, we'll just give them an interdisciplinary degree if they can't get. I think we need to have a little stronger wording, as the provost mentioned. I mean, interdisciplinary degree is seriously someone who wants to look at, you know, multiple disciplines together and come up with new knowledge. I mean, it's especially at a master's level.
I appreciate the comments about the interdisciplinary degree. The way I read it was that students would be invited to apply. I don't think that there was any inference that this would be an automatic thing. So they would have to go through the ordinary admissions procedure. So that should not really impact, I think, the status of this motion.
I can read the sentence. I don't feel that implication. But okay, I'll.
Yes, go ahead, Vince.
This is Vince. If I can attempt to address that, I would like to think that recruiting at the master's level can be very personal and oftentimes face-to-face with our faculty traveling nationally and internationally. While not 100%, many of our students are recruited through trips like that, and I would hope those negotiations, discussion, and dialogue would occur out there before students even choose to send in application fees and their materials, and they would know what they're getting into in terms of degree program, in terms of interdisciplinary programs with individual faculty.
Laura?
Yeah, also the interdisciplinary program has some very specific rules as well, so a committee needs to be in place and a plan needs to be in place before that person goes into an interdisciplinary program, so I don't see that as a problem either.
Okay, any other comments? All right, let's vote. Again, we're going to do it by voice vote. Boy, I'm having trouble with English. All those in favor, this is the motion to delete the current Master of Arts in Music. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by aye.
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 Opposed?
Opposed.
Opposed. Thank you. All right. Motion carries. Okay. We are scheduled for a break. However, we have a third motion from GAC, and I'm sensitive to the fact that Amy Lovecraft is here to do this, and I think your schedule is a little bit constraining at this point. Is that correct, Amy?
No, I just did my motion.
I'm actually the designee for Donnie for the last one.
You are. Okay. Yeah, why don't we go ahead and take our mid-meeting? Thank you. Okay, our third motion from GAC, you've been busy, GAC, is concerning the revision of bylaws that govern what activities and domains GAC operates in, and Vince, you have agreed to be the designee to present this one. So Vince, go ahead.
That's correct. Thanks. I'll draw your attention to Attachment 6. The committee in periodic review of the bylaws discovered two ideas that were discussed. One was to recognize the efforts of our graduate students and allow them to vote because they essentially take on some of the same work in reviewing courses and programs. And two, it was noted in the committee that it seemed odd that tax-related issues are in the bylaws, and the committee more or less focused on the idea that we don't have, none of us really claim to have expertise in that area. So we're asking for removal of that.
Okay, and you are, I assume, moving to adopt this motion. And do I have a second?
I second.
Thank you. All right, we may discuss now. All right, any questions or comments or concerns about this motion to Vince?
I have a favorable comment. I think graduate students should be part of the GAC committee, so I like the move to include graduate students.
I will comment that there was one concern that came up on the admin committee, and we satisfied ourselves that it wouldn't be a real concern, and that is the potential for, say, graduate students to vote on the administrative committee as a faculty member. That would not be a part of this motion. In other words, graduate students would not be representing the GAC on the admin committee and would not be voting on the admin committee. And we thought that was important since the admin committee is strictly a faculty body.
And, of course, makes decisions about things beyond GAC.
Correct.
I disagree. Do I say something or do I raise my hand?
Amy, you raise your hand is fine, but... And just a reminder, I heard a comment in the break that not everyone is speaking into the microphone, so if you can make sure that you're speaking into the microphone so that the remote people can hear us, but also folks here in the room. Go ahead, Amy.
I just would say that I was the lone voice of dissent for inclusion of graduate students in the committee, and I'll just voice that two things bothered me. One was the idea of up to two graduate students, that if we're going to actually include them as actual voting members, that it seems like we should know exactly how many graduate students would be voting. And I just had concerns about graduate students included in formal voting capacity on programs that might be their own programs. And so The idea that the graduate students would be voting at the same level as faculty members sitting on the committee through Faculty Senate and the graduate students not having been through such a process bothered me to some extent. So I just want to voice why I will again vote no on the motion.
All right. Thank you, Amy. Laura?
Yeah, I actually think that this is a fair point with regard to the own program, but what faculty right now does is they pretty much excuse themselves from voting. I mean, that's pretty much what Vince did when the whole music thing came up. So I think the same could be applied for grad students. Could be.
Okay.
So would that need to be included in the bylaws then?
I would like to see that addition that they, you know, I actually agree with Amy's concern.
So, David, your concern about them not being represented in the admin committee is not in this bylaw, right?
That's correct, because the admin committee bylaws are what will govern that.
Okay. So it's already taken care of.
Right.
Okay.
Amy?
I guess I'll raise a further point, and that is that there's not a mechanism here for how these graduate students are selected to serve, to sit on the committee, and that, I guess, was another aspect that troubled me. Are they just, you know, how do they find out about it, and then what's the mechanism? How do we know that we're getting graduate students who know and understand? It's, in other words, it's self-selection in a way that troubled me a little bit as well. I just forgot to say that earlier.
Thank you, Amy.
So they're not voted by a peer group or anything like that?
Well, I think right now those mechanisms aren't clear, and so that's one thing we actually try to address by having all of the committees review their what it currently is in the bylaws and by reviewing rules regarding membership and stuff. So we have to address that for all of the committees in some form or another. But I think that's a legitimate concern, is sort of not having some mechanism for selecting graduate students to serve on a committee like that.
Cecile.
Debu, go ahead.
Yeah, how were they selected before? Like, you know, we had two graduate students as non-voting ex officio members. And how were they selected before? Or were they...
Would somebody on GAC care to enlighten us on this?
I was actually assuming that the provost is appointing them, but Susan is quiet, so I'm maybe not.
Well, I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other, and it's really a faculty matter, I think, in terms of how you govern your own committees. I mean, I appreciate the conflict of interest issue. That seems easy enough to deal with. Beyond that, I really think the choice is up to the Senate and how you want to conduct your operations.
I've heard two, perhaps more, concerns. One is, how do graduate students get on this committee? And the second is what about student conflicts of interest? Right. And I just saw a hand go up. Yes.
I have a question. I mean, I can understand the reasoning for having a graduate student on the Graduate Advisory Committee. It makes sense. But I don't know enough about Faculty Senate to be able to phrase this correctly. I don't think that it's typical of most Faculty Senate committees to have students on those committees. Am I correct or incorrect?
Most of them don't.
Oh, yeah, that's correct.
So then the question are they formally a part of this committee because this is a committee for it's a graduate student advisory committee? You see what I'm saying? Or
yes.
Is this, I'm questioning why there are students on a faculty senate committee. That's what I'm asking.
Well, I was not around when they were first put on, but the rationale, which makes sense to me, is that this is something that they're intimately involved with, and that they can provide a perspective on graduate education that is valuable for the committee's work.
Absolutely, but you could say the same thing about a number of other committees.
Right.
And yeah.
Okay, thank you. Laura?
Well, maybe the other committees should add students then when appropriate. But, for example, students are also part of search committees, and I find that extremely appropriate. So, I am, again, member of GAC, and I find having the students on there has been wonderful, and they certainly are contributing just as much as each one of us does. So I think the intent of the motion is great, but I agree with Amy's concerns that it needs some wordsmithing in there still.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Laura. Debu, and then...
Okay. Yeah, two comments. When I was in University of Minnesota as a graduate student, I was part of the Faculty Senate, this kind of a committee, whatever it was called at that point of time. And so the second part of the comment was, we were selected actually by the graduate school dean at that time. And I don't know what the process was. I was sent an email, or not an email. I was sent a letter once, and this was pre-email I'm talking about. So letter once, and I received it, and they were asking me if I would like to serve on it. So don't know what the criteria was at that point of time. So we can adopt something similar also. I think it's of value to have graduate students to represent their own perspective.
and the graduate school dean selecting them. There is nothing wrong with that.
But I think the problem is that they might be representing just their own perspective and not necessarily the perspective of the graduate student body because they weren't independently voted into that position. They were appointed. That's my biggest concern.
Well, we need to educate them then properly.
Glenn, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Franz actually had his hand up first. Sorry, Glenn.
This is very short. I think the way it's phrased is actually kind of weakening the influence of the grad students. Before it said clearly two grad students, and now it says up to two, which means none is also compliant. Just saying.
How would I get in the queue too, please?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, say that again.
I just want to be in the queue for questions. That's all.
Gotcha. Okay, Glenn, and then you can go ahead.
I just wanted to say I share Amy's concern, and it's a generic one that this is a situation where you're allowing the voting privileges to people who are being evaluated for performing under standards that they are now participating in setting, and I think that's inappropriate. They are capable people. They've been involved here as an advisory capacity, and that's been very productive. I see no problem with that. But there is a line, and that's the line that I'd like to draw, that the prerogatives of the faculty are the people who have completed graduate requirements and demonstrated their capabilities and been through a selection process and are members of the faculty at an institution. They're the ones that set the standards and hold people to them, and that's a line I'm most comfortable with.
All right, thank you. Any other comments?
Yeah, in mine, please?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Todd and Dillingham again. There's also, I agree with everything that was said, and I think there's also graduate student associations in certain departments. I know biology and wildlife department has one. I think physics has one. I'm not sure about anthropology. Other people probably know of more. That might be a more direct avenue because they elected, from a disciplinary perspective, or at least a department perspective, they elected what graduate students they wanted to represent them. And then that might be a way that they can get the voices heard through faculty senate better than trying to find a way or a mechanism to get a graduate student on. And some of the other comments that were made were valid as well, whether we need this.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Laura?
Okay, I still have problems with that. So we recognize that grad students have a value input into hiring committees and are voting members of those representing the grad school union, but we don't allow them to have input on course schedule, syllabi, or anything grad student concerning. I find that ridiculous.
I would argue that's where the grad student associations would be putting their input.
Okay, thank you. Glenn?
Well, I just appealed to historical precedent here. In the mid-13th century, it was groups of students who got together and went to what were recognized at the time as scholars and said, teach us, okay, and then initiated what is the modern university. And it was appropriate then, and I think I don't see any deviation from precedent in that sense, but again, the specific concern I had was, and then if you're admitted as a student to seek a degree, you're expected to perform up to some standards, who is qualified and appropriate to set those standards and see that they're adhered to and make the judgments and evaluation and assign the grades and see if you've met the requirements of a degree. And by bringing the students who are performing under those standards into that process, I don't think it's appropriate.
They're not part of grading.
So I'm gonna just sort of make an observation at this point. It sounds from the comments that I'm getting the sense that this motion probably should be considered a little bit more by GAC. And I'm not allowed as chair of this body to make a motion, but I would entertain a motion to table the motion for further consideration.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, then we'll have a quick vote on this. The vote right now is to table this motion and refer it back to committee. So a yes vote says this needs more consideration by the committee. So all in favor of tabling the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries. It's tabled for further consideration.
Will there be guidance on what exactly they should reconsider, or are we just saying reconsider?
Right. I heard several categories of comments. One is concerning how graduate students are appointed, that that's not spelled out in the bylaws, apparently. The second is that there's a conflict of interest with respect to students potentially voting on programs that they're in and having a direct input in that. And then there's another section on whether or not students should be able to vote on what is essentially a faculty purview. And so I think what I've heard is that the GAC is being asked to consider each of those and respond to those concerns. Have I captured that correctly?
And also the up to?
Oh, and also the up to. Thank you.
Yeah, I took the up to as sort of the how. So with three of us here, I think we can convey that far. I feel comfortable.
Okay, thank you. All right, moving on now to another motion. This is motion F we're on, right? This is motion F, motion to amend the math placement policy submitted by the Student Academic Development and Achievement Committee and the Curricular Affairs Committee. And Cindy, you're going to come up and introduce the motion from here. Okay.
I'm not Brian Rogers. Turned on?
Yeah.
Is it on? No. Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. We talked about this at last Senate meeting. This motion's coming forward to you officially now for passage. This motion originated with a group of people, a committee of math and developmental math faculty who are looking for a better way to place students into math courses than the current methods, which would be AccuPlacer or SAT or ACT scores, and there are a couple other math placement varieties. What they're proposing is to use Alex, and Jill can speak to this a little bit more. She's on the committee. This committee has been hashed out pretty thoroughly in SADA and Curricular Affairs, gone back and forth. Reiner has had some input on it. I just want to point out a couple of things about this motion because they relate to things we talked about earlier. One is that the question of instructor permission comes up. It's on what I'm on my copy. It's page 37 at the top of the page. The last sentence in that bolded part says an instructor also has the right to waive a course prerequisite if the instructor, and it says provides there. Just cross that out and put has. That was something. That was a change that got made along the process that somehow didn't get my fault. Didn't get all the way through to the. This draft. Instructor has documentation that the student possesses background, the background required to succeed in the class. This thing has been through so many versions. anyway, so that's really where that conversation came from, is the fact that in addressing this placement motion, we also came up against the question of whether a student could get in by instructor permission, how one gets in by instructor permission. So this statement would be in the catalog. So that's just to weigh in on that other conversation. The other thing is you'll notice a couple places where instead of English it says reading and writing. You're going to be seeing a motion, keep your fingers crossed with any luck, in December that will address changes to placement into English 111 and developmental English, and some of that will be expanded on there. So I wouldn't... If we pass this motion, it'll pass that language, but there will be further additions and corrections to that coming in the next motion. So I wouldn't focus on that this time around. Jill, do you want to say a little bit about why this request has been made?
So in the Department of Mathematics, we began looking at how well our placement scheme worked, and we found that the present scheme is a bit of a hodgepodge and also isn't very effective. And so we began looking at other alternatives, and with the new placement scheme, it would mean that instead of getting it placed into math classes by ACT, SAT, a variety of other things, most of which are not intended actually as math placement, students would be placed via one of three methods, transfer credit, AP credit, or the UAF math placement test. That's what it would be called, and it would be an ALEKS product. And it is intended as math placement. It allows students to get placed prior to coming to UAF so they can do it via the internet. They have multiple chances, and the test gives them a lot of information about their mathematical skills, and it provides them with a tutorial to help them improve their skills. So a student can take the test, see that they're weak in trig. They can spend 2 hours working on a trig module designed for them, and then they can retake the test and get into calculus. It would cost the students $25, but if you put that up against how much it costs students to mistakenly enroll in calculus and fail, this is a giant money saver for students, and we think we'll do a much better job of placing students. And just to be clear, I whenever I use the word math, I mean math and developmental math. Developmental math is still math. so it's placement into DEVM and MATH courses.
And just a comment about the $25, I think that's been the biggest issue we've faced in discussing this, and I know the provost office and the registrar's office and the business office, I think, have been discussing ways to roll that into student course fees. One of the questions that came up was if a student has to pull $25 out of her or his pocket to take this test, that would be a barrier for some students, particularly rural students. Whereas if it can be rolled into course fees, it can be part of scholarship or grant award funding. So, Reiner, have we left anything out?
Yeah, the key to getting this successfully done in terms of how the registrar's office is going to do it is to pass the motion. While it's still kind of a theoretical, maybe we can do it, there isn't a whole lot of impetus to actually setting up a mechanism. And if we can get this thing passed soon, then we can work on a mechanism that's going to make this relatively easy and seamless.
Jane, do you have anything?
So just to say that all developmental math faculty at all UF sites agree with this motion.
As do the math faculty.
Okay, I'm going to assume that you've made the motion. Can I have a second?
Can I quickly ask a question? In your statistics where you looked at the performance of these tests, have you taken into account transfer students and students outside the state and inside the state? Is there a difference? And does it hinder us in accepting outside students, or is it neutral for that?
I think your question is, did we look at students who placed via ACT and were within UAF versus students who placed within Alaska versus those who placed by ACT outside of the state? We didn't look at that.
Because I mean there's arguably a difference from students coming outside or being inside and also transferring. And so I'm wondering if that creates a hindrance for us. I've seen it a couple of times that the students get judged or placed in the wrong category, or that the whole admission process is different and so on. Like, does it affect us?
So this, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, but this placement scheme should be great for students no matter where they are. That is, all they need is internet access, and they can access this test. So a student who applies to us in India or Washington State, they're going to get a message saying you need to take the UAF math placement test if you don't already have math credit. And they can, from their computer at their home or their favorite coffee shop, log in and take this.
Okay, I just hate to do this, but I really do want a second from somebody.
Second.
Who would, thank you.
Second.
Oh, we can discuss.
I'm sorry, did I answer your question? In other words, unlike something like ACT, where you have to set up a time to take it, unlike Accuplacer, where you must take it proctored at a special Accuplacer place, this test does not require any of those things.
How about if a person is in a rural village and doesn't have internet access? Is there a mechanism in place for that?
So we've had a lot of discussion with the faculty there, and this is precisely why we have allowed them the option of choosing some instructor permission. That is, that instructor gets to decide what they think is appropriate, and there are many options. One may be that they do come into a campus that has internet access, which is how they're managing AccuPlacer now. An alternative is they use the paper-based placement, which they're also using now. So it would mean that for those students, there might be little change.
Okay. Let's see. All right, Anna, and then Libby.
Sorry, a little bit of a picayune question. If they can take it from anywhere, including a coffee shop, et cetera, how do you verify that they're actually taking the test as opposed to, does
could they cheat?
Well,
yes, they can. And
so
and
how
in fact,
is that going
wait. And we actually. We looked at schools that have used this. This has been implemented in schools for more than 3 years now, and Washington State implemented it, and they checked for cheating. They checked for cheating by checking to see if someone could, in the matter of hours, jump by more than a course. They called that cheating. Now, I've used Alex before with students, and I have to say it's remarkable how quickly a student can progress if they really knew the material once upon a time and it's merely been a couple of years. But if you say that this is an appropriate measure of cheating, they found that there was about 18% of their students cheated, and they still found dramatic increases in the success rates, that is, the pass rates in their courses. That is, even with cheating, they found pass rates went up.
Okay, Libby?
I just wanted to clarify that this is for students registering, so it could be non-degree students. It's not an admission requirement that we're changing. So students who apply for admission and get, you know, go through that full process still can take ACT or SAT or a bachelor's program, AccuPlacer or Compass or a two-year level test for the admission requirement. This is to register for a math class.
Right. Thank you for the clarification.
And I believe it's for the initial math class, because once they've registered for the initial math class, then their performance in that class will be placement for the next class.
Yes, that's true. Thanks.
So I'm just bringing two comments that I got from our faculty so far. Okay. Again, I polled this one. I got two different. One was a verbal one, and it said that some of our courses require 105, 107, or 105, 107 is under, yeah, 105, 107, and for smaller programs, it might be difficult to recruit students if we have some more stringent requirements. I don't know. I guess we are very unclear about the Alex yet. That's the whole problem I see.
Yeah.
As opposed to that, the other faculty member who sent an email, which I have, said that they support this one because this is a more stringent requirement for math placement, and the person supports, or the faculty member supports this one. So
I would say it's not. It is probably a more stringent requirement in that it's a more nuanced test. In other words, students are going to know really where they stand, and if I understand it correctly, they get a pie chart. So they get pi for doing this. They get a pie chart that tells them where their areas are that they need to work on. So they can click on the area and get support for that area. In terms of the 105, the DEVM 105.
No, I'm thinking 107, 108, I believe. Math 107, not DEVM. No, it's Math 107, 108. Yeah. Trig and pre-calc.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to change anything for that. Students will take this test in order.
No, I'm personally in favor of this one, but you know that's my personal view. I'm just bringing the comments.
And there was another question, right?
Yeah, as far as the comment about the internet access, I guess I don't know what village that would be because any community with a school has internet access. And the cheating, I mean, they're only cheating themselves.
Yeah. Actually, in terms of internet access, I know that in certain areas in the Aleutians, the Pribilof Islands, there are days when you can go without internet access.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, they do have it. It's just that they might have to schedule it.
Well, you can't schedule it sometimes. I mean, a lot of it's weather dependent or whatever. It's technology dependent on the.
This is on demand. It's an on demand test.
Oh,
take it any time.
Yes, they can take it any time. But the point is, it's not always easy in the bush.
Okay. Any other comments or questions concerning this?
One little comment. Is there any final level difference between an SAT and the ALEKS? I mean, despite that ALEKS seems to be a step up, while the others is just one exam, and that's it.
Could you repeat the comment? We couldn't hear
it. I was wondering about the level of mathematics that actually we are imposing here. I mean, if it is the same level that we have before with the SATs, or if it is finally when they integrate all those sets, actually they reach better levels or not?
So the mathematics that's being required isn't any different. The issue is that SAT, for example, you simply get a score. You score a 600. It's actually possible to get a score that places you into calculus and not get any trigonometry questions right. I mean, SAT is intended as a college placement exam, not as a math placement exam. And so the mathematics isn't changing. It's just that now we're going to use a test that actually tests mathematics in a topical and specific sense. Have they seen an exponential function? Because if the answer is no, they shouldn't be in business calculus. Does that make sense?
It's
math. It's topic specific for the student and ultimately for the score that places them.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Do it.
Let's have a vote. Okay. Now, the maker of the motion, Cindy, has revised the motion to substitute the word has for provides. So I want to make sure that that's clear before we vote. That's concerning the documentation for waiving course prerequisites. Okay. So as amended, we'll have a vote now. And all those in favor of the motion for this new math placement, please say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Okay. Carries unanimously.
Yay. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. All right. We move on now to governance reports. Brad?
Hello. So when I was last here, I think we had staff council, staff affairs committee had just put out two surveys, but a survey on a question of tobacco or smoke-free. We now have the results of the survey. If it's not online on our blog at uafstaffcouncilinfo.blogspot.com, it will be probably by the time you get back to your workspaces. We asked four questions. A quick summary. When asked if staff would support smoke-free or tobacco-free totally, or just tobacco-free, the answer was 57% no, 43% yes. When asked if UAF property should go completely smoke-free, the answer was split, 50-50. I'm sorry, and there were 785 responses, so that 50-50 split was 389 for, 389 against, with 7 abstaining. So the takeaway seemed to be that it's not necessarily tobacco products that bother people, it's the smoke. And on our fourth question, we asked about would you like to restrict smoking and tobacco use to designated areas? 22% of those responding said they would want to restrict both smoking and tobacco use to certain areas. Another 22% said they would want to restrict smoking to designated areas. Another 27% said they answered yes, i.e. that is they would want to restrict both tobacco and smoke use, tobacco use and smoking tobacco all over. So generally the takeaway seems to be it's walking through smoke that really bothers people. And we had 330-odd comments, many of which were focused on not wanting to walk through smoke, particularly, say, around Gruning, but also not wanting to institute a ban. So staff affairs hasn't actually met since we put this survey out. They'll be meeting later this week, and we'll be putting together a resolution for how we'd like to approach this. One suggestion is encourage UAF to enforce its current 50-feet smoking bans, or you know, perhaps do better marketing, for lack of a better word, to say this really bothers people when you smoke in, say, a walkway, you know, or you smoke within sight of a door. Otherwise, you know, the staff council is concerned about the budget. We've heard a lot about that. We'll be looking at shaping Alaska's future and what that means for university and for staff. And I think that's about it. If you have any questions, I'll take them.
Okay, thank you, Brad. Questions for Brad, the president of staff council? I should have identified you as that.
That's all right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, do we have anybody from ASUAF? And is Danny here? No. Okay. So we move on to United Academics. Falk, do you have anything you wanted to report?
No, nothing to report.
Okay, thank you. And UAFT, Jane?
Nothing to report for either UAFT or the Joint Healthcare Committee.
Thanks very much. Do we have any member comments, questions, or announcements? Libby, go ahead.
Very quickly, I just wanted to pass out a couple pieces of information. We're trying to promote the Google Docs that we have. A lot of faculty members don't realize that we do have the Google Docs, and we prefer that you use them when at all possible.
Okay, just to clarify, there are a lot of things, and I just found out about this. There are a lot of documents that, you know, I'll go to somewhere and try to get it to, you know, to submit some sort of documentation to the registrar's offices as is needed. It turns out that they're all available on the registrar's Google Docs site, and it's very handy. So
many of them are. It's great because we often get emails, many emails, that say, please let Jane into my class. I don't know which Jane, and I don't know which of the many classes you teach. So if you use the Google Doc, you have to put in specific information. Also, you have to justify what your reason for the override is, which in the case of like the engineering folks is very important for their accreditation. So we actually keep records of these. If you submit it through the Google Doc, we keep the record. And then they can go back and use that when questions of accreditation come up. So we really appreciate you sharing that with your colleagues and encouraging them to use it as much as possible.
Thank you. I was just going to add.
The second is just a brochure that kind of spells out what we do in our office. We're a very big office. We do a lot of things. And you often don't know who you need to call, but you know what you want. So if you look inside, I know I want transfer credit, then I know one of the phone numbers here is who I call. So you don't necessarily have to know who, but it breaks it down department by department within Office of Admissions and the Registrar.
That is great. Thank you so much, Libby.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Are there any other public comments? Oh, Debbie, you have a question.
Yeah, I have a comment about the Google Docs, just for your feedback. I always try to use the Google Docs, and it's the most difficult thing to find for engineering. I'm sorry to say that, but every semester I have to fish through through the docs, and finally our associate dean of academics sends me a link. That also becomes an arduous task to get to the docs. My suggestion would be to have some place where we can go and click and get to the docs, you know, easily.
Okay, is it that the location is difficult to get to?
Yeah, some reason. I'm saying this for the last three semesters that I have been trying to use this.
Okay, and I appreciate feedback.
All right, thank you. Okay, no other public comments? Oh, more questions, I'm sorry. I keep looking at the clock.
Sorry, I'll make this very quick. So I was approached by a member of the faculty that I'm supposed to represent with a question, and I emailed you guys, and the idea is that maybe it's not the right time yet to bring it before Faculty Senate, but I just wanted to summarize the issue and see what Faculty Senate, you guys have to say about the procedures. And I think we have a public representative here from CLA. The issue is classroom assignment, and the classroom assignments seem to be opaque and perhaps getting more opaque and problematic. There have been changes in the recent few years regarding, for example, number of smart classrooms, number of sections offered by other groups, including, for example, TVC. That's not a blight or slight or whatever on TVC. It's simply there are more and more users of classrooms, and that has apparently affected various departments adversely to the extent of not only affecting class offerings for several semesters, not just one semester, but also has affected workloads and faculty-dean interactions and so on. The goal would be to increase visibility in classroom assignments so that we know what the criteria are and how to approach a problem. And to that, to that purpose, I guess the thing that I, as the representative of CLA, need to know, need to know, is what is the process to bring things to Faculty Senate, what types of data are needed, and what actions can Faculty Senate do beyond, say, I mean, is it resolutions and so on? What actual power do we have in this respect? So those are my questions, and I think we also have Tim Wilson, who at the public comment time could probably tell you more.
Right, and actually this is public comment time, so Tim, do you want to? Okay, kind of quick, just because we're short on time.
Hello. I understand that classroom assignment is a difficult situation for everybody on campus, and there aren't enough classrooms. As Anna said, I think the process by which classrooms are assigned, it seems kind of mysterious. We can't figure out what we need to do to get a classroom. We, particularly in Spanish, just seem to, half of our class this semester did not get a classroom. And then at the last minute we scrambled and we managed to find something for most of them, although not all of them. A couple of classes were so remotely assigned classrooms so remotely that no one took the class after all. These are classes that normally have 25 people, but so it's a real big problem for Spanish and some other, a few others, majors that I know of. It's really strange. We can't tell if it's alphabetical because it seems to be later in the alphabet. The majors that are later in the alphabet that seem to be the problem. So we would just like to know the process by which. So that's why I come to ask for your advice, I guess, to find out what you think I might do, or if anybody else is having this, this situation. But the process by which classrooms are assigned so we can find out what we could do. We've put classes at night, we've put classes online, everything we can do to try to alleviate the problem. But when our 100 level classes can't get a classroom, even though they're fully enrolled, those classes feed in 200 level classes, which feed in the 300 level classes. I mean, that's a big problem for us. I know some others, for example, Russian and others that are later in the alphabet. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's coincidence, because we don't know the criteria by which the classes are assigned. But anyway, that's our situation. So I wonder if you all had any advice for us. Thank you.
So I'll just briefly comment, because my experience has been that it's pretty piecemeal by college and then by department, based on who controls what space. And that's a... I'm sorry, but that's been my experience. So I appreciate you bringing this issue up. We don't really have time to address it in any level now. But perhaps what we can do is maybe put together some sort of an ad hoc task force, let's say, to look at the problem in more depth and see what sorts of problems exist across campus, and then what potential solutions might be offered.
I think one of the problems is that, and this is why we sort of had this sort of comical interaction here, that it sort of varies across campus to some extent. I think there are some classrooms that are controlled by a department or a college, and there are other classrooms that are controlled by the larger scheduling room assignment people. And so the rooms that you're referring to in Greening, for example, are part of that larger room assignment office. And that, of course, complicates things because, when you don't have control over any of the rooms, it becomes more difficult. When Anna brought up the topic, I agreed. I think it obviously is a huge problem. We're running out of good spaces for teaching. But I think rather than sort of discussing it based on our own rather narrow experiences, I think it would be good to really to get systematic data from across the campus of what actually is going on. So how many sections are not getting rooms. Where are they? So are there places on campus that are particularly hard hit by this? Are there colleges that are particularly hard hit by this? Is it you know, rooms with specific technological requirements? Is it other types of rooms? So that, you know, we can discuss it a bit more nuanced and with a bit more focus on where. But that's what that task force could do.
Right. Can I just make one more quick, super quick? I know everybody wants to go home.
Home.
Go back to work. We aren't looking for anything technologically advanced. One colleague said, if I could just have a broom closet with a chalkboard, I'd be happy. But right now we're in the hallways. Another thing that happened this semester for the spring, which is very interesting, is that the people who assigned the classrooms took it upon themselves to change the cap of the course. How many people our dean requires to have, you know, or maybe it's college, I don't know, the university. You know, a certain number of people in the 100 level, and they just changed that to a lower number, below that number that's required. So I think 20 are required, and they changed it to 12 or something like that. They didn't ask us, they didn't ask our chair or anything. So I think that sort of thing, it seems extra extraordinary to me. That
Libby? Yes, go ahead, Libby.
So my office is responsible for a large amount of the classrooms that are assigned, so if there are issues, I'd like to know. We do have a lot of construction on campus, and that could be affecting things, so some things are offline. But we don't change caps on classes. That comes from the admin of the department through the college, and they assign a numeric, you know, so many seats. So if something changed, I would start there.
Yeah. No, this was not changed by our admin.
Okay.
So that would have been on the dean, in the dean's office. It may have been just a mistake that somebody, you know, it may have been an older number in the database or whatever. So that's why, you know, when we get our schedules, we always check to make sure that those caps are still correct in the way we want them.
But I agree, it would be good to compile all of the concerns so that we can maybe look at what the issues are for some classes.
And I'll tell you what, if any of you are interested in working on this, let me know, and I'm going to probably talk to Tim and Anna after this because they seem like they'd be good chairs of a task force on this. Okay. Any other public comment?
Yes.
Or members' comments? And there are the minutes from the various committees are appended to the agenda. Are there any committee reports that you'd like to make in addition to those committee chairs that are left here? Okay. Seeing none, we sit adjourned.
Oh, I didn't realize. Okay, I thought you were the student.